Season 3 of Ding Dong Darkness Time is sponsored in part by Local Hero Press, a publisher of quality fiction. With its entire catalog available in audio, you can hear works such as Ian Thomas Healy's long-running and popular Just Cause universe of superhero novels. You can also grab Allison Dixon's terrifying novel Strings, yeah, that's me, and even Healy and Dixon's co-authored epic steampunk adventure The Oilman's Daughter. All Local Hero Press audiobooks are available from Audible and iTunes, and you can find them in ebook and print from every online retailer, including Amazon and Smashwords, or ask your favorite indie bookstore to order you a copy. All you little ding-dongs who love a great read should visit localheropress.com for more information. Now, on with the show. Bonjour and grüezi, my lovely legion of listeners. After a fun stint of COVID over Thanksgiving, the class of cults is back in session here at Ding Dong Darkness Time. I'm Allison Dixon, and so far in season 3, I've brought you a comprehensive primer episode with my two powerhouse psychology pals, Chris and Dr. Bart. I then gave you a short glimpse at cults of the Neolithic era, and then a dive into the political side with the Unification Church, aka the Moonies. Today, however, I'm bringing you something distinctly doomsday flavored, complete with a heaping scoop of New Age thinking, murder, and mass suicide to go along with it. Most of you probably automatically called up Jonestown or Heaven's Gate when I mentioned some of those things, but that's also why this episode is not going to be about them. There is no shortage of podcasts, documentaries, and books about Jim Jones and the People's Temple, or Marshall Applewhite and his merry band of hopeful comet passengers. That said, today I'm going to talk about an organization that's like the weirdo occult love child of those two. It combines elements of the Knights Templar, Aleister Crowley, and Rosicrucianism, as well as loads of sex and secrecy, financial grift, arms dealing, the belief that Jesus would return as a solar god king, UFOs, a little bit of white supremacy, and of course, classic ritualistic white robes you only wear when you're looking to live up to a mystical cliche of some sort. But before I get into the Order of the Solar Temple, I want to first give a shout to another listener who submitted a cult question. As a reminder, if you have a question about cults you'd like for me to answer on an episode this season, please drop me a line in an email, ddarknesstime@gmail.com, or hop on over to Twitter or Facebook and leave something there for me. Listener Kate asks what my thoughts are on whether or how cults function similarly to abusive relationships. It's a question packed with enough answer to fill an entire episode, but I'll answer it here because it's another opportunity to remind folks that the machinations that make a mind subject to control and domination by another person can happen on any scale. From a single interpersonal relationship with a parent, friend, or romantic partner to an entire group comprising hundreds. And that's because in both instances, the person is beholden to someone they see as a powerful, charismatic, often infallible leader. Anytime you start to see another being as the answer to something missing in your life, you open the doorway to a whole cognitive obstacle course that forces you to suppress or sublimate your questions or troubled feelings. An abusive partner, for instance, might tell you that whatever hurt they've caused you happened because of something you did or didn't do. And because they've likely established a pattern of manipulation that began with them bombing you with love and adoration, it becomes that much easier for you to believe them. After all, if their claims that they love you are true, then it has to be equally true when they start cutting you down for something, right? This is where all the gaslighting begins. Furthermore, cult leaders and abusive relationships all involve some sort of dependency. Maybe they're holding the purse strings, or maybe it's more spiritual or sexual or all of the above. Either way, it's the goal of those who like to dominate and control the minds of others to make you start seeing yourself as a ball of problems that only they can help you solve. Recently, another listener used my Cults Primer episode as a helpful guide to understanding how narcissists manage to so easily convince people they're not guilty of crimes we know very well they committed. I'm looking right at you, Casey Anthony. Anyway, I was happy to see this, specifically because understanding all the other ways cultic mindsets can develop and manifest outside of typical cult settings is the key to understanding that none of us is immune to this kind of thing. And it's important to keep this in mind when speaking about cults themselves, because as we'll see today, this kind of manipulation and thought reform can lead people down a very dark path that ends in death. So, since this is an episode about a doomsday cult, let's talk a little bit about what that is. Well, it's about as self-explanatory as it sounds. The term doomsday cult became a popular part of general parlance in the 1960s when sociologist John Laughlin studied the Unification Church. And now you're probably asking yourself if they themselves are a doomsday cult and why I didn't plop them into this episode instead of the one on political cults last week. After all, the Unification Church does indeed hang a yoke of apocalypse around its followers' necks in order to keep them in line. Well, cults can behave a little like a Thanksgiving dinner plate. Some of the dishes can touch and combine, and you're going to see a lot of that as this season wears on. Also, as I explained last week, so much of what the Moonies did, and still do to this day, is about societal mainstreaming and political infiltration, which they've successfully done here in South Korea and Japan, to name a few. To me, they're a political cult that happens to be using religion to control people. But a doomsday cult, like, say, the Order of the Solar Temple or Heaven's Gate or Shinrikyo, the cult responsible for the sarin gas attack on the Tokyo subway in the 90s, behave a little differently. They're more inclined toward insularity and secrecy, usually because the kind of manipulation techniques they use to keep people in line veer often into the illegal, abusive, and grotesque. And they're all about the apocalyptic prophecy. They often name specific dates for the end of the world and get their followers fixated on it. One of the most important tools in a cult leader's kit is getting a follower to feel like they're in on a very big secret. It gives them the purpose and meaning they're seeking. And if that predicted date comes to pass with no great rapture, lake of fire, nuclear bomb, UFO visit, or otherwise world-altering event, well, there's always an answer. You, the faithful follower, misunderstood the leader's message. Or perhaps it all hinged on your willingness to believe, only you didn't believe hard enough. A leader also might claim to have received an updated message indicating the date's been postponed for a few days, months, or years, like so many social gatherings in 2020. And although many doomsday cults can lose some followers once a proselytized date comes to pass without event, for the most part, the group doubles down. Why? Well, in the Primer episode, we talked about something called the sunk cost fallacy, where the sum of time, money, and resources invested in an enterprise justifies a continued investment, regardless of a failure or setback. You tell yourself it's temporary to keep pressing forward, much, much easier than admitting you've been wrong about something the whole time. And sometimes that mindset can be okay, right? When you think about, for instance, if you're like a candidate you'd been backing for office loses, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to, you know, dump the entire party and the platform that you've been a part of. And you don't necessarily want to do that if it's a cause that you believe in. It often means that you have to go back and try again, back another candidate, and hope for a better outcome with voters. However, it's a little different when we're talking about a arbitrary date predicting the end of the world. Furthermore, it's just hard to let go of that feeling that you're in on something exclusive and special. And if the leaders keep dangling that carrot in front of you, more often than not, you're going to continue to chase it. It's like me waiting for Nintendo to announce a new Mario Kart game. It never happens, but damn it, I keep holding on to hope, despite becoming increasingly convinced it'll never happen. Anyway, I should note that there are some people who believe the use of the term doomsday cult can be a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you happen to be in a group that exhibits some of these characteristics and people refer to you with such a negative sounding term, you might just dig yourself in deeper, go even more underground, and possibly even escalate your desire for violence. This podcast and others like to use plainer language for the purpose of helping ordinary people understand these concepts on a very broad level. But in more academic settings, or if you're dealing personally with a loved one who might be a member of such a group, this sort of terminology tends to alienate and obfuscate more than help. You're not going to get them out of that cult by holding them by the shoulders and screaming to them that you are in a doomsday cult, snap out of it. It just doesn't work that way, unfortunately. And it might even harm alternative groups who have no nefarious plans, but who can still be marginalized by communities and governments who prefer to lump everyone under a few strictly defined categories. This is why a lot of books, research paper, and other media prefer using terms like new religious movement when referring to specific groups. Just something to keep in mind, although we will probably continue to use a lot of shorthand in this podcast going forward. So let's talk about the Order of the Solar Temple, shall we? By the way, for short, I'll be referring to them interchangeably as the OST throughout this episode. As I've been doing my most recent round of research on the OST, I started to think of them as the Temple of the Dog of cults. That is to say, like the band Temple of the Dog from the 1990s, which was an amalgamation of members of Pearl Jam and Soundgarden, the Order of the Solar Temple was its own sort of supergroup formed by the leaders and members of separate cults. One of the group's two main founders was Luc Jouret, and he was a former Belgian paratrooper turned physician who eventually became obsessed with homeopathy and other non-traditional methods of healing that involved holistics and the paranormal. Somewhat good-looking and charismatic, Jouret was forming his own impressive group of fans and giving lectures all over Europe. Following one of these lectures he gave to a New Age group in Switzerland called the Golden Way Foundation, he paired up with that organization's founder, a much more mysterious guy named Joseph Dimambro. Now, to get something basic about the Order of the Solar Temple out of the way before we talk about Dimambro, there's nothing particularly special about the OST. And by that I mean, around this time over in France, Switzerland, and other parts of Europe, there were about 30 small cults and factions who claimed to be descendants of the Knights Templar. I'm sure you've heard of those guys, and I'm not going to do a long piece on them here, but suffice it to say, they were a Catholic military group that emerged and flourished during the Crusades and operated throughout the 12th and 13th centuries. They were extremely wealthy and had a lot of favor with the popes of the time. But eventually, as all big shots ultimately do, they would invite someone's jealous ire. And that someone was King Philip IV of France, who was in a lot of debt and started raiding the Templars' coffers for himself. Eventually, he stopped trusting them due to a series of military failures, probably because they were being systematically bankrupted, but whatever, and he ordered Pope Clement to have them disbanded. Many of the knights either fled or were tortured and burned at the stake. Clement permanently disbanded the Templars in 1309, and it happened so suddenly that their legend never really died. Imagine if we just decided to up and cancel the Navy SEALs one day. No real explanation, just bleep bloop, outlawed, disbanded, and scattered to the winds. The rumors and speculation would captivate the world. That's basically what happened here and why some knowledge of the Templars remains to this day, even if it might be from a shitty Dan Brown book, but I'm not going to judge there because I've read several of them myself. And many groups have tried to claim some sort of lineage to the Templars. Over the 8 centuries since their disbandment, many have tried to reform the order to very limited success. This is why if you look at photos of some of the Order of the Solar Temple members, there aren't many, but you'll find a few out there in the Google sphere, you'll see the red cross of the Knights Templar emblazoned on their white robes. This feels like all the attempts to reboot the Fantastic Four, but I digress. So as I said, the Order of the Solar Temple was not the first one to try this. And that co-founder I mentioned earlier, Luc Jouret, was dabbling with one of these factions in the early 1980s called the Renewed Order of the Temple. He tried and failed to take control of it when its founder died, so he found himself without a cult to call his own. And that is when he met up with the Golden Way and Joseph Dimambro, who, in addition to his New Age leanings, had been dabbling in Rosicrucianism at the time. Oh dear God, another $10 word with a possibly long tangent attached to it. Am I right? Well, to put it very simply, Rosicrucianism became a thing in the 17th century and is an esoteric spiritual movement that borrows from other spiritual and metaphysical practices such as alchemy, Kabbalah, and Christian mysticism to assert that there is an ancient magic and order to the universe that's hidden from the regular world. And through a series of secret gatherings and rituals, the special members of the group can get at those secrets and protect them. Furthermore, a lot of these groups are, to put it very plainly, extremely white, and believe that that secret order involves a good bit of white male domination. This is why a lot of these heads of these organizations are often found to be aligned with a lot of right-wing political organizations as well. If you took it further down this rabbit hole, we'd end up lost there for hours and hours on end talking about the Freemasons and probably a dozen other secret societies, which are essentially cults for very rich and powerful people who want to use their wealth to feel even more exclusive and in on some big secret. To further illustrate what the Rosicrucians were all about, legendary occultist and practitioner of sex magic, Aleister Crowley, dabbled with them in his earlier days when he was just beginning to explore the whole mysticism thing, and it's still very much a thing to this day. So, essentially, Luc Jouret and Joseph Dimambro, their woo aficionado statuses firmly on lock, decided to pull a gatekeeper and keymaster and summon Gozer by forming their own group claiming lineage to the Knights Templar. These guys are starting to seem as ubiquitous as Elvis impersonators in Vegas. The official name of the organization was called the International Chivalric Organization of Solar Tradition, and its HQ was at Dimambro's own Foundation of Golden Way offices in Geneva, Switzerland. Luc Jouret, being the more outgoing of the two, took on the whole outward-facing recruitment side of the enterprise, while the more secretive Joseph Dimambro handled the ritualistic stuff and back-of-house financial operations. There were layers to this whole thing, mind you. One does not simply join the Solar Order. That's for the elite, the best of the best. In other words, extremely bored, rich people who maybe like to be tied up and spanked. Not that I'm kink-shaming, but I'm just trying to paint you a picture here. You would begin your journey into this inner sanctum by attending one of Luc Jouret's homeopathic healing seminars, where, if you were really won over by his theories on love and biology, you would join something called the Amenta Club. But say you had a stronger appetite for mystical knowledge. Well, there was another level, another special group you could buy your way into called the Arcadia Club. And there were even more levels beyond that. According to the literature of the OTS, the central authority was the Synarchy of the Temple, whose membership was very secret. Its top 33 members, and by the way, the number 33 is always going to be very significant in the area of Freemasonry and other secret societies, and even Nazism, to be very plain about that. You can learn a little bit more about that by visiting all the way back in episode 2 when I talk about the Denver International Airport and all the weird little iconography happening in that place. Anyway, the top 33 members of the group were known as the Elder Brothers of the Rosy Cross, which is just a more casual way of saying Rosicrucians. And I guess, you know, a little easier to say in general. And their headquarters were in Zurich, Switzerland. And the order had all these different lodges, and each lodge was run by a regional commander and three elders. And you could progress in the order and the different levels. And there were like three grades per level. There were the Brothers of Parvis, the Knights of the Alliance, and the Brothers of the Ancient Times. And that goes in ascending order. In all of these clubs and levels, the teachings of Luc Jouret were a big part of it, and they were offered both to the general public and privately to the more ingrained members. Each lodge had an altar, they performed rituals, they had their costumes, and members were also expected to make very expensive purchases to gift jewelry and pay very stiff initiation fees. And during the ceremonies, members would wear their white ceremonial robes with the red crosses on them, and they would hold a sword, which Joseph de Mambro claimed was an authentic Templar artifact given to him 1,000 years ago in a previous life, because of course. And to quote the New York Times article I will be linking in the show notes, initiates into the inner sanctum of the order were to accept severe discipline. It didn't elaborate on that, but does it really need to? Well, the OST seemed to be enjoying a good deal of success after a couple years, and in 1986, the cult set up their official headquarters in Montreal. There, they invested in a complex of chalets some 50 miles north in the city of Morin Heights, and this became the official HQ of the Order of the Solar Temple. Their followers invested hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not more. Some estimates say over $1 million was donated to Joseph de Mambro and Luc Jouret throughout the course of this cult. And Jouret coaxed them to leave their homes by saying a great cataclysm was coming and only he had the power to help them survive it. And yes, he invoked Jesus Christ a whole lot. In fact, he not only told members of the cult that he was an original member of the Knights Templar in a previous life, he also claimed to be the third reincarnation of Jesus himself, and he would use this authority to coax women to engage in sexual rituals with him ahead of ceremonies because, you know, you gotta be feeling that Holy Spirit just like coursing all through you and all through somebody else too. That's just how that works in a lot of these cults. They're usually just an excuse to get together and bang a lot. So far, though, this is all pretty standard descent of the charismatic leader into madness after years of huffing his own farts. But what's really fascinating and not a little frightening about this was the way Luc used his ties with local officials in Quebec to infiltrate the main electrical utility, getting several members to join up. And that might not seem like such a big deal on its face, but think of how you'd feel if you learned your access to electricity was being controlled by a doomsday cult, and the implications if they decided to hold that access for ransom. Further, as the activities continued into the 90s, things started to veer more and more off the rails with Jouret and de Mambro. Increasingly, they engaged in arms deals and other shady activities. This is according to the New York Times piece that I pulled up on this from actually 1994 and 95, not long after the end of the Order of the Solar Temple. The Canadian police apparently suspected that Jouret was into some really bad stuff. So soon after he arrived in Quebec, they asked Swiss police for information about him. By 1992, they believed that Jouret was behind a paramilitary group known as Q37, which threatened to kill the province's public security minister, Claude Ryan. So we're getting, again, veering into political cult type territory here. It's that Thanksgiving dinner plate that I had talked about earlier. And the sect was also investigated for possible links to bombings of two transmission towers from the Hydro-Québec. That's the utility company I mentioned earlier. Joseph de Mambro did not surface in any of the police inquiries that were made, but reports in Canada now say that he operated an arms trafficking ring that included money laundering through Swiss banks. And some former members of the cult say that de Mambro always controlled the finances. And once police began to start looking into this, Jouret got a little freaked out and decided to leave Canada and go back to Europe. And he traveled frequently, though, to France, to Switzerland, not only to give lectures and find new members, but he would also preside over meetings and rituals. And he also maintained his hold over followers by inviting people from Canada to come visit him in Europe, and so on and so forth. And in Switzerland, he and a group rented a mansion, and they owned a lot of houses throughout Geneva, as well as a farmhouse out in Chiry, which is a village 48 miles to the north of Geneva. And they also bought several chalets in a mountain hamlet some 45 miles to the east. So they had a lot of real estate. And in France, they also owned a healthcare center on the French Riviera and some other property throughout that country as well. The source of the money to pay for this all came largely from the sect members, apparently. There were some also big financial contributions from major businessmen, and a lot of those people ended up becoming part of the mass suicide that I will be talking about in a little bit here. But let's be very clear here. If you're going to join an organization like this, you're already going to be pretty wealthy and affluent. I think that was a big part of the draw. And Luc Jouret just had a way of insinuating himself into these very higher-end elite groups. Meanwhile, though, back in Quebec, things were getting really dark. In October of 1994, a member of the Order of the Solar Temple, Tony Dutoit, had an infant son named Emmanuel, who was 3 months old, and the baby was murdered in the group's main headquarters in Morin Heights, Quebec. He had been stabbed repeatedly with a wooden stake, and reportedly Demombro ordered this because he identified the baby as the Antichrist and believed that the Antichrist would be born into the order to prevent him from succeeding in his spiritual goals. So things escalated very quickly once we start getting into the mid-90s, about 10 years after this cult was formed, which really indicates, in a lot of cases, these cults that are built this way and they continue to grow and grow on this big bubble of narcissism and power tripping, eventually things are going to just start spiraling out of control. And that began with the murder of this infant. And sensing that they didn't have much time left as free folk after the murder of this baby, this is when Demombro and Jouret were determined to find another route, while also not relinquishing their power and influence, mind you. So they developed this mass suicide plot where they would shed their earthly skins, attain a higher spiritual status, and escape to a planet orbiting the star Sirius. Joseph Demombro and his inner circle even enjoyed a lavish Christ-like Last Supper ritual because, of course, if you're going to either be the third reincarnation of Jesus Christ or his right-hand man, that's exactly what you're going to do, correct? So between the properties in Switzerland and France and Quebec, 53 members of the Order of the Solar Temple, including Jouret and Demombo, killed themselves. The inner circle folk, 15 of them, used poison. 30 were killed by bullets or smothering, and another 8 were killed by other means that weren't made entirely clear by the research that I did. It seems like they probably murdered the lower member groups, and then the final 15 took themselves out, I guess, in a less violent way. Because again, of course. In Switzerland, many of the victims were found in a secret underground chapel that was lined with mirrors and Templar symbols, and they were dressed in the order's ceremonial robes, and they were laid out in a circle with their feet together and their heads outward, like a star. And most of them had plastic bags tied over their heads, and they had each been shot in the head. And an interesting thing about the plastic bags, apparently, they were a regular part of the rituals with the group. They symbolized their alienation from nature. And there was evidence that many of the victims in Switzerland were drugged before they were shot. And there were other victims found throughout several chalets, including many dead children as well. It seems that a lot of the children of the cult members went with their parents, although there was at least one or two instances where some of the children were found drugged but alive in sheds. And not only did they poison and shoot themselves to kill themselves, they also set up remote control devices that would set the houses that they were in on fire. And this is what brought the attention of the authorities, was the fires. And I imagine, too, they did that to destroy a lot of the evidence of their rituals and the other secrets of the order. Which is also why, in addition to the fact that most of the original members are dead, there isn't a lot of information. This is still a very highly secretive cult. If you try to research this, you're not going to get a whole lot of concrete information about what this cult did, all the activities they engaged in. They managed to fly very much under the radar and keep a lot of their activities undercover. And I imagine a lot of that went up in flames with the rest of them. But as the officers rushed to the sites to fight the fires that had been ignited by these devices, they found farewell letters that were left by believers that stated they believed they were leaving to escape the hypocrisies and oppression of this world. This is also very similar to the motivations and final words left behind by the members of the Heaven's Gate cult that also engaged in mass suicide in California in the 90s. They weren't only looking to hail a comet, hail Bop, to ride to another celestial realm, but by that point, they had already shed themselves of any earthly associations whatsoever. They were highly, highly isolated and did not feel part of this world anymore. Just imagine a super mega ultra introvert group. That is ultimately what the Heaven's Gate people were. Whereas the members of the Order of the Solar Temple, they were a lot more ornate. They were a lot more affluent. I keep using that word affluent, and it's going to keep coming up throughout the rest of this episode. So bear with me here. And to really drive that home, the sort of type of people that were members of the Order of the Solar Temple, we had a mayor, a journalist, a civil servant, a sales manager were found among the dead in Switzerland. And in Quebec, the police found records that showed members had personally donated over $1 million, as I said before, to Demombro. And there were further attempted mass suicides of the remaining members throughout the 90s. All of them occurred around the dates of equinoxes and solstices in relation to beliefs of the group. This is according to the Wikipedia article, but I was able to corroborate a lot of this in other newspaper articles. Another mass suicide incident related to the Order of the Solar Temple happened on the 15th and 16th of December in 1995. This was about a year after the mass suicides in Switzerland and Canada. And on December 23rd of 1995, 16 bodies were discovered in a star formation in the mountains of France. It was found later that two of them shot the others, and then they then committed suicide by firearm and immolation. So again, I think they had it rigged to have themselves set on fire after they performed the suicide. And among the dead was actually an Olympic athlete, Edith Bonlieu, who had competed in the women's downhill skiing in 1956 Winter Olympics. So again, these were not small potatoes type people. These were typically very accomplished. These were wealthy. These were not people that you would automatically associate with being desperate and missing something in life, right? Because when we think about highly accomplished people, we think, oh, they've made it. They've attained something. So what is going on here? I'll get to that in a bit. On the morning of March 23rd in 1997, so this is continuing again over several years, five members of the Order of the Solar Temple took their own lives in Quebec in the town of Saint Casimir. A small house erupted in flames and it left behind five charred bodies for the police to pull from the rubble. And three teenagers aged 13, 14, and 16, who were children of the couples that died in the fire, were discovered behind the house in a shed. And those were the ones I mentioned before, that they were found alive and heavily drugged. So there are a lot of instances here where the kids either went with the parents in the suicide or they left the kids behind and took their own lives. I will leave it to you to decide which is the worst fate. I think obviously murder is worse, but I cannot feel anything but agony for those kids left behind this mess. And a renowned Swiss musician and conductor, Michael Tabachnik, he was arrested as a leader of the Order of the Solar Temple in the late 90s. And they actually indicted this guy for participating in a criminal organization and murder. And they tried him in France during the spring of 2001, but they acquitted him. And further after that, they actually appealed the verdict and tried him a second time, because they don't do the whole double jeopardy thing over in France, apparently. That is a fun little American perk. They tried him one more time in 2006, but then he was cleared again. So I think that they finally decided, okay, they're not going to be able to really get anything to hang on this guy. And in some ways, that's understandable too, because I don't know how high up he was in the level of the cult, but I do believe that there becomes a matter of how accountable are you really once you've been brainwashed to a certain extent. And it could be very hard to prove a lot of these factors or hang them on one person, especially when the leaders of the cult have already offed themselves. And so when they were uncovering the fiery ashes and the ruins of these burned down chalets in France and Switzerland, when the bulk of the members, the 53 members, killed themselves back in 1994, they discovered a lot of things left behind that didn't go up in flames. Inside the chalets, they found walls decorated with symbols inspired by Catholicism, astrology, spiritualism, Templarism, again, Rosicrucianism. There were golden chalices used to burn incense. There were white, red, or black robes that they wore depending on their rank. And there were paintings of Christ-like figures with a rose above his head. Again, I think that Rosicrucian aspect was a very important of the symbology that the Order of the Solar Temple used. But there were some survivors, and they talked as well. And one former member told a Swiss newspaper that drugs were used often in this cult as a control mechanism. To quote him, he said, "They had the habit of putting drugs in coffee or soup. That's how they forced me to sign papers I did not want to sign. And we were often given coffee before the rituals." And again, I think that also accounts for why that other guy was acquitted in the trials that he was put on, because there's no telling how amount of drugs and other forms of coercion were used on him. And Mr. Jure's own writings and recordings have been found as well. And he was found as saying, quote, "I have learned to face death, or at least to make it sweeter, more welcoming. The present chaos is the chaos of reorganization from which a beautiful rose will grow." That's, again, it feels very reminiscent of the things that we see, you know, at the very end for Jim Jones, the Applewhites in Heaven's Gate, is that they are making the temptation of suicide that much sweeter, not only for themselves, but for their followers. But namely, this is a power trip for them. Yes, they are under their own hypnotic sway from the stuff that they now believe, but there's always going to be a part of a lot of these narcissistic personalities that become these charismatic cult leaders that know exactly what they're selling. And it's really the power trip that they are having and getting other people to follow along. And even if they themselves are willing to step off the side of the cliff, we can't really say that 100% about Jim Jones in terms of him stepping off the side of the cliff. While he did die, he did not drink the poison drink in Guyana. He ended up being shot in the head. And then there's a Swiss expert in cults, Jean-Francois Mayer, who said at least 2/3 of the members of the Order of the Solar Temple were women. And he recalled that when he met Mr. Jure in 1987, he had a plan for cosmic marriages to unite 100 families that would survive to the end of time. And then there were other former members who began telling their stories as well, although they didn't share their names. They all described Mr. Jure as authoritarian, paranoid, and messianic. So he was quite full of himself. And there are actually some video recordings of him out there telling people that he is the third incarnation of Jesus Christ. Once you've reached that level, then yeah, I think messianic and authoritarian is probably a good way to describe you. For instance, he would have these crazy orders that he would give to the cult members, like you have to wash your lettuce 7 times before you serve it, or you have to walk on grass with bare feet. And another woman who spent 2 years of the group, she said that people would just obey him like they were machines. And this, again, is another very common thing that you see in a cult member. over time, especially once the leader starts to spiral and the cult members don't know how to get out, or maybe they are so fully programmed that they don't see anything wrong. So it could go either way, but for the most part, these people are stuck in a cycle that it takes a lot of outside help to get out of. And of course, they didn't have that. And then, of course, other people talk about a different side to Luke Jouret. When he was last seen in the town where he ultimately performed the mass suicide, he was buying plastic bags from a store. And the locals there said that he was very popular. He was handsome and he was always very engaging. He talked about how he would give people copies of his book, which honestly, as someone who writes books, that can also be seen as a bit of a douchebag move. But for the most part, people would say that he was very chatty. He was very gregarious. He was always waving. He was always open and talking with people. And they saw him in town the day before his death, having no idea what was to come next. And in fact, Pierrot Jacquet, who was a carpenter who built the chalet where Mr. Jouret lived, he said he knew him really well. And when he saw him the day before he died, nothing seemed unusual. But the following morning, Pierrot was pulling charred bodies from Mr. Jouret's burnt down house. Finally, as we're starting to get to the end of this here, the Solar Temple was one of many new religious movements during the 20th century that ended in murder-suicide. I've already mentioned the big ones, but there were also a lot of little ones too. And the Solar Temple just seemed to fly under the radar, I think largely because it occurred mostly in Canada, Switzerland, and France. It didn't have much of an American connection, so it always felt a little distant to us here. But obviously, we are no stranger to those events here in America either. And they talk about how the affluence of the temple's membership challenged the notion that such incidents are the product of people being deprived of something. They suggest instead a more ideological cause. And I want to circle back to that idea because the behavior of this cult and its behaviors being the result of affluence and ideology is one that I still think is not discussed enough. And I want to quote from a recent Twitter thread written by Tom Nichols of The Atlantic. I actually encountered this the other day and was kind of blown away by it. He wrote a book called Our Own Worst Enemy. And while he's speaking here about the rapid rise of anti-democratic movements across the world, I believe it applies perfectly here as well, because not only are cults often an expression of dysfunctional and abusive relationships, they can also be reflective of larger political movements and situations. Nichols says, "Among many reasons the rest of us have had a hard time comprehending the descent of so many Americans into mass psychosis is a belief that anyone who embraces such nuttery must have traumatic reasons for doing so. But it's affluence and plenty, not trauma, that led us here." And so he talks about all the research that he was initially going through when he wrote his book, Our Own Worst Enemy. And the more research he did, the more he found that this whole discussion about economic and political class was based on nonsense. He really didn't see how it was often the problem of people who were desperate and poor and who had nothing that were causing a lot of the anti-democratic movements that we're seeing today. And he says the threat was from people who were part of the dominant economic and political class. They were not part of the cultural elite. He said the danger was not some unemployed guy on opioids. It was from a bored woman named Marge who was tired of being married to a rich guy and having affairs at the CrossFit gym. But to realize this is to realize that the problem is huge and perhaps impossible to solve. He goes on to say, "Americans love problems we can fix. If only we cared more about the empty towns. If only we spent more on addiction. If only we could bring back good jobs. But what if none of that will work? That's the scary part, and so we reject it. There is no bill you can pass, no social program that will solve the problem of a dentist or realtor who has decided that life is just too goddamn dull and that they're gonna spice up their week by getting some tactical gear and cosplaying the Second Civil War." He's, of course, referring to the insurrection, but it speaks very much to the heart of something like the Order of the Solar Temple as well. When you have enough, when you have plenty, when you have more than enough, you tend to not have as much struggle. And so you have to fill in that vacuum with something. He does end his thread by saying, this doesn't mean we're hopeless, but we have to stop thinking we can fix or legislate our way out of this by rebuilding the downtown of East Cupcake or handing out free college. Those ships have sailed. The way out is harder, if simpler. For example, concentrate on local issues as a way to build civic resilience. Speak forcefully for civic values instead of being intimidated by kooks and not joining cults. That is what I would add. And do not argue with their nuttery. Again, telling your loved one or friend that they are in a cult is the one surefire way to get them to dig deeper into that cult. And of course, get together and outvote them and do all this in concert with like-minded citizens. I also want to leave you with one final quote that can perhaps encapsulate Tom Nichols' ideas even further. And this comes from Francis Fukuyama from The End of History and The Last Man. He says, but supposing the world has become filled up, so to speak, with liberal democracies, such as there exists no tyranny and oppression worthy of the name against which to struggle. Experience suggests that if men cannot struggle on behalf of a just cause because that just cause was victorious in an earlier generation, then we will struggle against the just cause. They will struggle for the sake of struggle. They will struggle, in other words, out of a certain boredom, for they cannot imagine living in a world without struggle. And if the greater part of the world in which they live is characterized by peaceful and prosperous liberal democracy, then they will struggle against that peace and prosperity and against democracy. It is an interesting paradox and conundrum, right? We ask ourselves frequently why we aren't capable of utopia. And there are a lot of explanations and there are a lot of people who will philosophize on that concept. But I think that when we are looking at an absence of struggle, we do have a tendency to create our own. And it sure seems to explain a lot about what we're seeing in the world today and how the solutions aren't nearly as clear-cut as we might like them to be. We're all fighting against some deeply internalized human urges here, and the vigilance that we have to maintain is growing ever exhausting. But I do firmly believe that we can rise to the occasion. And ironically, and especially as we talk about the dangers and pitfalls of cults week after week this season, requires us to do the one thing that seems to have worked against the Order of the Solar Temple and other like-minded groups who met disastrous and toxic ends. We need to stick together. It's messy and difficult when we're talking about managing a group of independent thinkers, many of whom will have differing backgrounds and opinions on how things should go. But that's the secret ingredient in the sauce of democracy. The discussions and the struggles serve as crucial gut checks, ensuring that we're not painting ourselves into a corner where our only way out is to flag the nearest celestial vehicle to another planet, aka suicide, or terrorism, or war. All right, ding-dongs, I think that's going to do it for this week. I'll be doing one more short episode for next week before taking the rest of the year off to enjoy the holidays and recharge the batteries. I'll still be busy researching and writing in preparation for the Class of Cults picking up next year. And don't worry, there will be more friendly banter in store with some guests. Trust me when I say that the best is yet to come in 2023. If you have any questions about what I've talked about here or cults in general, please feel free to email me at ddarknesstime@gmail.com or hit me up on Facebook or Twitter. I'd also love to hear from you in the form of a review over on iTunes. It's the best way to make the show visible in the algorithms and hopefully make it grow even more. In the meantime, I'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. Ding Dong Darkness Time has been brought to you and produced by yours truly, Allison Dixon. It was made possible by an array of amazing co-hosts, friends, family, but especially you, the listeners. Big shouts also go out to the brilliant Nathaniel Dixon for the show art and future legend Spencer Morlock for all the music. I'll be back again soon with another episode. In the meantime, be good, you little ding dongs.